Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for this warm welcome. Thank you, Hans. Thank you, Gürtchen, for inviting me to this conference. Each year it's a great highlight to spend a few days with you in such distinguished company and talk about important things and sometimes also less important things. As the night goes on, the less important things become dominant, but they are part of the convivial order of human beings, about which I will have a few things to say today. Well, democracy has been covered a lot by our distinguished guest, Hans Hermann Hoppe, who has become famous in our day as a critique of democracy. But of course, as Hans did not tire to point it out himself, democracy never had really a good press with political thinkers in the past. The only reason why it's somewhat different today, why there's virtually no professor of political philosophy or of political science who says anything against democracy, is because they're all paid by the state, and they're all paid by the democratic state. So all people who are somehow intelligent have something to say against democracy and cannot bring themselves to make the sacrifice, the intellectual sacrifice, to the god of our time, right, democracy, well, have no place at state-funded universities. So if we look into the past, now this is a bit of disorder here. I have here various people. So this is, in the middle is Plato and Aristotle. Both of them lived in democratic Athens, and they were not fans of democracy, right? So certainly not fans of the democracy of their time. So this was for them as a rule of the proletarians, right? A rule of the mob rule, and they were not in favor of that. They were themselves inspired by Plato, who comes a bit later. For me, the initial impetus for choosing this topic was I'm not really working much on democracy. I'm very much a student of the topic, like you know, most of in this room. Came from an encounter with just this gentleman, who is Augustin Cochin, who is a French philologist and philosopher, historian, who died at a young age, at the age of 39, in World War I, in one of the Somme battles. So this is him working in the archives. And Cochin had become, in his day, a famous critic of the French Revolution and the origin of the French Revolution. And by historical studies, he delivered really a demonstration that the French Revolution was anything but a spontaneous democratic uprising. It was very much the result, and more or less the inevitable result, of several decades of preparation in what Cochin called the Société de Pensée, so I'd say intellectual clubs, very much like our club, right? But these intellectual clubs that emerged in France in the 18th century were inspired by Rousseau and by Rousseau's theory of the social contract. So the purpose of these societies was to form the public opinion, the will of the people, la volonté générale, so that an informed political process could take place. So the operating principle of these intellectual clubs was that people would gather together and discuss about all things. And they called themselves, amongst themselves, the philosophes, right? They were all philosophers by virtue of of being member of the club. You were a statutory philosopher. And then at the end of the meeting, or of several meetings, they made a decision, a collective decision on what the right opinion or what the right value was on any topic. So in this way, right, they prepared both intellectually, but also especially as far as the organizational preparation is concerned, the advent of the revolutionary days of 1789. And it was not an accident that the revolution then turned into a democratic revolution of this model that had been for so long prepared. And Cochin, he emphasizes at some point that I will come back to talk about in my present talk. Then, of course, our Hans Hermann Hoppe. And there were two images lacking. One is Socrates, okay? Socrates got in trouble with the Athenian authorities of his day for two things, right? For worshipping strange gods, and the strange god that Socrates was worshipping was the one god. There's only one god, right? There's not a multitude of gods, there's only one god. And he had come to the conclusion that there can be only one god by a purely theoretical, philosophical argument, not by any theological or divine revelation and so on. And that's what made him so unpopular. in his day. And the second ground, but it was a derivative of the first, the second ground was that he was seducing and spoiling the youth, right? He was teaching things that were not amenable to be profitable to the polytheistic society of Athens of his day, very much that. And Hans had become politically unpalatable by preaching, well, that democracy is not the god of our time, right? There's whatever the god is, it's not democracy. So it made him very unpalatable in Las Vegas. That's a little outline that will follow. I will first try to make a case for democracy, for the good democracy. So the democracy that is part of a free society, a society that could be appreciated by libertarians because it is based on the respect of private property rights, and so emerges as a spontaneous arrangement of people within a convivial order. Now, I use this term convivial order, borrowing from a philosopher that I admire very much, namely Frank van Doorn. He is a professor of law at the University of Ghent. He is now an emeritus. He has for many years a speaker at this conference. And Frank, in his work, he had always distinguished between three basic forms of the social together. One is the convivial order, so that's the libertarian society, which is based on private property rights, people dealing with each other as equals, and so on. The second one is society. So in society, you introduce the element of representation, like, for example, in a commercial society, in a firm, and you have some people who are directors and so on. Then you have hierarchy, you have subordination, and all these things. And the third one is the community. Right? So community based on shared convictions, shared values. Of course, in the case of a family, but then also can be a religious community, an aesthetic community, a philosophical or theological community, or monkish order, or whatever. And so they are based on authority. You don't have an organization, but there is deference to a common authority, like we have deference in the society to our good friend Hans Hermann Hoppe, right? So he's the authority within our little club. So can be distinguished from convivial order and society. So I'll develop the idea of democracy within a convivial order, libertarian order, and then distinguish it from democracy of a coercive sort, and then develop further how the introduction of the state modifies even a coercive democracy, and then highlight some of the cultural and political consequences that follow from it before I draw some practical conclusions. So in the democracy within a convivial order, I think we can distinguish three elements that come into play, namely conventions and contracts. We always have some voluntary representation, so there is representation, but it's voluntary, and we have voluntary subordination. And of course, in a coercive democracy, all of these elements become coercive. And it results from them some sort of a natural democracy that we find instantiated very rarely in history, but at least we get some approximations. So fundamentally, and this is a theme that Augustin Cochin emphasizes very much in his opposition to these his critical research on these sociétés de pensée, which were geared toward collective decision making. Well, he points out that first of all, in a normal social situation, it's very rare that we find any sort of agreements. Agreements are very much the consequence, the spontaneous consequence of the social together, rather than something that springs from the nature of things themselves. Now, as an economist, let me phrase this a bit differently. As an economist, we know, thanks to Plato, Aquinas, Ricardo, Mises, and all the economists today, they explain to us the benefits of the division of labor. The division of labor is beneficial for all people involved on material grounds, right? Each person involved in a division of labor can obtain more goods of material, spiritual, or whatever sort, than he could possibly produce on his own, right? And the only key to this little miracle is that he cooperates with other people who are different from himself, so the talents must be different. So that's the incentive to cooperate with other people. it makes that, as Mises has pointed out, it makes that people who are prone to be aggressive and distrustful and so on of other people, well, they're still drawn toward these others because they have a material interest to do so, right? So even if we dislike others, they're shabby socialists and gender theoreticians or advocates and so on, we'll still cooperate with it. We're selling them goods. We are hiring them among our personnel and so on, because we're benefiting from their cooperation. So that's a little miracle. The difficulty is, of course, to come to terms, right, to find an agreement. And here, Cochin emphasizes this point, and I think it's a very important point, that the natural state of affairs is that we don't agree on things, right? We don't fully agree on things, right? Even if it's purely descriptive, if you wish to describe, what does this bottle look like? Now, I were to ask each of you, well, describe this bottle, I guess out of the 60 people or so in this room, we would get, 59 different descriptions of what this is and how it looks. And so we don't really agree on this. And if you have really an argument with your wife or with your husband, you'll find that, well, sometimes you think it's obvious how things are, but they are not, right? Apparently not. There's very different ways of seeing the world and of appreciating the different elements of the world. Right? So it's a laborsome and difficult process to come to some sort of agreement. And the agreement that we reach, well, they come through speech acts, of course. They come through argumentation, they come through threats, different sorts of things that come into play. And so we share our view with these others, the gratuitous act, right? And then we exchange, right? And we, in exchange, of course, we come to a partial agreement on what we want to be done, right? We have an agreement that does not necessarily cover all of our world, all things that are somehow relevant, but a very narrow specific area in which we say, yeah, here, you own this, I agree on this, you are the owner of this apple, I'm the owner of the pear, we agree, both I'm the owner of the pear, you're the owner of the apple, now let's exchange. That's really what's going on in exchange. It's a very partial common ground that we find. And that's the beauty of an exchange, by the way, because it shows that we actually don't need to agree on everything in the world. Right? We can still cooperate on a partial basis. And that's really the starting point of civilization. Now, as Hans Hermann Hoppe has pointed out in his work, that of course, in any exchange of the sort, there are certain prerequisites that even though they may not be explicit, invariably involve practically. So there's always involved a recognition of the other as something, somebody, a person, different from ourselves, a person, not just an individual or a thing, a carrier of rights and obligations, of claims and obligations, with whom we can make a deal. And so implicitly, there's some sort of convivial equality that we recognize because we are exchanging as equals in thought, in speech, and in rights and obligations. And the result of this, the spontaneous consequence of this, is the convivial order. It is what emerges when people are free to operate with each other. There's no institutional impediment that prevents them from finding common ground, as far as it goes, to share ideas and be rejected, misunderstood, disagreed with, and so on, but also find common ground for cooperation, for exchange, for intellectual activity, and so on. Various thinkers have underlined the productivity of disagreements within a convivial order. Right? So many, especially the democratic theoreticians, but many people today in political science, but also in economics and other social sciences, I think fall prey to the error of assuming that agreement is a particularly desirable state of affairs. It's good that we have community based on full agreement and so on. Whereas Mises and others have always underlined the productivity of disagreement. And the basic exhibit A here is always what's happening in an exchange, right? If I exchange a pear against an apple, well, there's a disagreement about the relative importance of these goods for me and for the other person. We just agree that, well, he's the owner of that thing, I'm the owner of the other thing, and we want to switch property rights. That's the only thing on which we agree, but not on the significance of these goods in the world. Right? So exchange would not take place without disagreement. But then, of course, disagreement is also fundamental for market competition. What happens in market competition? Well, people pursue different projects. or they pursue different ways of producing a car, different ways of producing bottled water, and so on. And they're competition with each other. They don't want to cooperate. They want to do their own thing. And this is really the spring of progress, intellectual progress, knowledge, and of course material progress, as we know so well. I move on very quickly. So the next element that we can also distinguish on a purely voluntary basis that is part of the convivial order is voluntary representation. And of course we know this from the various forms of voluntary delegation with which we are familiar, right? We have wards for people who cannot take care of themselves, very small children, very old people, handicapped people, and so on. They need somebody to take care of them. Commercial agents for firms, club presidents, and various others. Now, in a purely voluntary setting, let me highlight that such representation is characterized by its limitations, right? It's limited especially by two elements. One is the means that can be used by the representative. So it's a delimitation of the stakes. How much of our time may he use or may he represent, and how much of our material goods may he or she use? And the other one is the finality. To what purpose may the representative engage myself or act on my behalf? Similarly, there's voluntary subordination. Of course, we know this from community, which we find natural authority. Parents are natural authorities of children, because children, as they know by experience very well, they wouldn't get well along with mom and dad. There would be no meals on the table, no protection from the evil boys living next door, and so on. And so there's natural authority in here, in a family, but also in a larger community, the village community, and so on. Then we have conventional authority, and here we come back to Frank van Doorn, who distinguishes this element. Let's think of a commercial society, right? We have a firm, maybe a corporate firm, and so there's a board, and so on. The board is the representative of the firm. There's subordination. Employees execute the wills of the directors, but this is conventional. That is, it's authority granted by contract. The employee, this is another economist of our time, Pascal Salin, he has very much emphasized this point, right? A contract of an employee does not, strictly speaking, manifest a hierarchical relationship in the sense that the employee is the serf of the Lord, right? But it's hierarchical in the sense that that the employee consents to being directed by the director in a very limited field, right? In the 8 hour or so period per day that he consents to rent out to the employer. One German sociologist, Robert Michels, in the early 20th century, he had destroyed the egalitarian hopes of German social democracy by pointing out, well, there's an inherent tendency in any social organization to turn to oligarchy, right? So the proletarians within the SPD, the social at the time it was still the Socialistic Party of Germany, they were desperate that the higher ups were hanging out at parties with the capitalists and so on, were very much behaving like capitalists, and so says, well, this is just an oligarchy. It's not the ideal society that we would wish for. And Robert Michels tells them, look, I mean, this is not at all unnatural or surprising. It's what you should expect in any social organization, because in any social organization, there are always people who are more interested in doing certain things, so they invest more time in this, and there are people who are just better, naturally better at playing the game that is at stake. So you're, for example, running a political party. So these people naturally come to rule the party. And the same thing was pointed out by various sociologists, by the way, already in the 19th century, and Augustin Cochin also emphasizes this point. Now, what I should like to point out here about this oligarchy is likely to be small or even absent in purely voluntary subordination. And the key reason is that you have a purely convivial order, exit costs are low, right? And it's always possible to exit, right? So there's no obligation for anybody. We are not forced at a gunpoint to stay within the party or stay within the organization. You can switch to something else because there is, in principle, competition is admitted. And that's one of the big differences as compared to the present-day political system, which is very much so rigid and monolithic, because exit costs are increasingly high, because typically they are illegal, and you cannot completely exit the whole system. So therefore, within the purely convivial order, there's something like natural democracy. Now we need to pay attention here, right? So democracy, the word has these two elements. So there's a demos, right? So there's a people, and they rule, right? There's this katein. Now katein, strictly speaking, is coercive. Right, so in a way, right. So what I'm describing here is a theoretical construct of a libertarian theorist, right? So the voluntary democracy, by the name itself, democracy is always coercive, right? So, but yes, so it's the rule, it's the voluntary rule of the people. Theoretically, it's conceivable within a theoretical convivial order, and it comes as a spontaneous effect of conviviality. Mises and the American economist Frank Fetter, have described that this democracy naturally results from a private property order, because private property is fundamental in a market economy, and the market process itself is an element of democracy, right? So Mises called this market democracy. Right? Every dollar is spent is like a vote cast in favor of this and that product. And Murray Rothbard has proposed a very nice comparison between the market democracy on the one hand and political democracy in his book Power and Market. You find this on the opening pages of Power and Market. Okay, I need to hurry up, and I will. So in coercive democracy, right, we have three elements. We have coercion, and coercion we can define along our libertarian economists as a violation of private property rights, right? So it's a deviation from acquisition of property by homesteading and by contract and by pure gifts. And what distinguishes coercive democracy is that people are coerced at the point of a gun, if necessary, into collective decision making. Right? So they cannot make certain decisions on their own. They need to make them in unison with other people. So this is a very elementary form, a theoretical form of democracy. So we forget about the state, we forget about political parties for the moment. Right? We just say, okay, we all agree, like in a Société de Pensée in the 18th century, on certain things we only proceed in unison. We do not make any decision in deviance from what the others think or what the majority thinks. And any deviation will be punished. So in that moment, the element of decision becomes crucial, and actual agreement on any issues recede in the background. Right? It's not necessary to convince everybody of the truth or of their interest in a certain deal. What is necessary is to bring them to the point that they decide in this direction rather than in another. Right? And this decision may just involve, well, I'm choosing the lesser evil. I'm not convinced both things are wrong or both things are bad, but because I'm obliged to choose, well, I have to choose one thing or another. And clearly, this changes the attitude toward others. And again, Augustin Cochin he emphasizes, well, that as a consequence, well, lying, manipulation, preparation of meetings and so on take place in such a context. So the other is increasingly, the other person is not seen as a partner, as a person equal in principle in rights and in obligations as ourselves, but as a victim. I should not take care of. And another consequence that follows from it, from this political process that now sets in, well, is the formation of political parties. So my argument is that political parties are a necessary consequence of the collective decision-making, coercive collective decision-making as such. They do not just result from the introduction of a state, but they come from collective decision-making. Because if decision is the crucial element, well, then we have the interest in gearing decisions toward the right result. As a consequence, we get a tendency toward political centralization within each party and cartelization of the different parties in themselves. So I don't have time to develop this now, but the parties have common interests. Typically, all members of all parties want the party to play a greater role in the political process, so they have common ground there, and they therefore have the incentive to strike deals, come to partial agreements with all the other parties as far as their shared common interests are concerned. So the natural consequence is a growing opposition between the representatives and the represented, and the emergence, therefore, of a political system. And so we're talking about a situation we don't even have a state. And the what is interesting in Cochin's study is that he shows that the system emerges in a pre-state phase. Even if the state is officially monarchical, you just create this element of collective decision-making, but see, it generates a process that leads to this result. So the state, of course, reinforces all bad elements of of the collective coerced decision-making process, right? Because the state can create legal monopolies, most notably in money, law, education, information. The state, through various means, through regulation and also to subsidies by paying for advertisements in TV stations and in newspapers, can create propaganda on its behalf and so on. And the state can also eliminate competition, right? By co-opting any people who have some talent, some political oratorial skills, and so on. They're co-opted, right? That's what all the transatlantic foundations do, the Fulbright, and I don't know what, right? So they bring in anybody who can barely speak three sentences in a row without screwing up, right? They bring them all in, and of course they eliminate competition as far as possible. We see it in Germany, for example, in the fight against the AfD, and in the US, the hysterical opposition to Donald Trump. And then last element is, of course, coercive democracy. Well, it's really the representatives who run, who consider themselves to be the owners of the whole country and so on. And all others are just elements that may be more or less compliant or disturbing, right? Disturbing the order. And so if necessary, well, we export any people who do not comply, and we import people who are likely to comply. Now, I really definitely run out of time. Okay, So you see, right, I oppose Mises' case for democracy. Okay, I won't go into this. Coercive democracy is not a culture of rationality, of reasonableness. You find much material on this topic in a book that Hans-Hermann Hoppe edited some 20 years ago, The Myth of National Defense, especially in the opening chapters. And which we see, I mean, there are systematic reasons why democracy entail a very emotive, emotional way of interacting with others. And it's again, it's linked to this basic element that in a coercive democracy, what counts is the decision. It's not agreement on anything, it's the decision that counts. So as a consequence, you use all the techniques of mass manipulation, which are typically appeals to emotions rather than reasons, right? Both because most people are limited in their intellectual abilities, and emotional appeal is much more rapid than a long-winded argument and so on. Like, few people have as much time as we do and discuss things for hours and hours in the evenings here, the pleasant evenings of Bordeaux. And we get a culture of legalized robbery, of course. In the old world, we had slavery, okay. And I think slavery has not really ended, because if you pay more than 50% of your annual income in tax, well, I don't know which other word you wish to use, right? And even if it's just 30% or 20%, you're a partial slave. I mean, that's the plain fact. So we get a culture of legalized robbery, which is reinforced by our present monetary system, of course. And then finally, we get a move away, very strong incentives to abandon the monotheism for which Socrates, Aristotle, and Plato found theological grounds, and which were developed then by the Christian philosophers, theologians, and also by Muslims and Jewish theologians. And we get a turn back to the good old days of Roman and Greek polytheism and corresponding relativism. Right? So in conclusion, right, the root of the problem seems to be coercive democracy, not democracy as such, which reminds me of a very charming incident. One of the first things I learned from Walter Block, when I met him, Walter told me that he met a good German friend of mine, Stefan Blankertz. He is a well-known libertarian philosopher in Germany. So Stefan goes to some libertarian conference and brings his sister, okay? The sister is a communist. So she walks up to Walter Block and says, "Hello, I'm so-and-so Blankertz, and I'm a communist." And Walter takes her hand and looks at her very friendly and says, "Oh, my name is Walter Block. So you're a communist, voluntary or coercive?" And that's a crucial point, right? So as a libertarian, as an Austrian, we have no reasons to be opposed to democracy in principle, right? It's not democracy that is really the problem. Voluntary democracy is fine, right? As long as it's competitive, as long as you can get in and can get out, the root of the problem is coercion always, right? And then as far as practical reform is concerned, well, we need to push toward the reduction of the extent of the state. We need to work on getting rid of legal monopolies of the various sort, especially central banking. And of course, we also need to come back to the to inverse the hierarchy of norms, right? So hierarchy of norms means international law comes before national law, comes before regional law, comes before local law. And the sound hierarchy in a libertarian society is from bottom up. Communal rules come first, all regional rules are complementary, subsidiary, and then the same thing for national and international, right? And as Frank von David Dürer has explained to us, there's even no reason why we enshrine this into law, right? Can be competitive. So let's go medieval in that respect. Well, thank you very much for your attention.